Good morning, or good afternoon, or good evening, depending on which part of the world from which you are joining us. Thank you for being with us at Brookings. My name is Bruce Jones. I'm the director of the Project on International Order and Strategy here at Brookings, and it's a pleasure to host you all here today. This is the third event in an ongoing series of the dynamics of a resilient order, or as we sometimes call it, shockproofing the order. We met with the Spanish foreign minister in October around a report that I did with Susana Mocora on what we called the long crisis of multilateralism. We met in January with John Eikenberry on the challenge of defending and projecting democracy in the contemporary international order. And today we're delighted to welcome Kai Sauer, the Undersecretary of State for Foreign and Security Policy from Finland, to join us in a panel discussion on the challenge of strengthening the multilateral order in an age of nationalism, with a particular focus, I would say, on European dynamics and transatlantic dynamics. I also want to thank the Finnish Foreign Ministry for their support to this project, and as ever, for their respect to our independence and the independence of our scholarship, which we cherish and for which we're very grateful. We're going to be joined today by two Brookings scholars who have thought deeply about these topics. First will be Tom Wright, who is the director of the Center on the United States and Europe, and also a fellow in the Project on International Order, and who's written a terrific, challenging paper on strengthening multilateralism in an age of nationalism. And I'll ask him first to offer some thoughts from that paper. We'll then go to Kai Sauer for his thoughts from a Finnish and a European perspective, and then turn to Constanze Stetzenmüller, who's the Robert Bosch Senior Fellow at Brookings, focusing on Europe and US-German relations, for her reactions and thoughts to the two initial presentations. I've then suggested that we do a second round with the team, challenging ourselves, all of us, to think constructively in the short term, despite the scale of the challenges that we're outlining. What are some concrete steps that can be taken in the near term to improve the dynamics of multilateral cooperation and improve the effectiveness of the system? With that, let me turn the floor to Tom Wright. We are not under the Chatham House rule. This is on the record. Tom, pleasure to see you again. Over to you.
Thanks, Bruce. And it's a great pleasure to be a part of this. And it's a great pleasure to be part of it with Constanze and Mackay as well. And I look forward to the conversation. So, you know, I don't propose to summarize the paper, but I would just like to make some sort of starting remarks on sort of the motivation behind it and some of the arguments, because I think we're at a moment, Bruce, where we have the Biden administration coming in. There's a lot of optimism, I guess, that the multilateral system can be reinvigorated. You know, they're rejoining all different types of institutions. Europe and many other countries have been proposing different ways to improve multilateralism. And, you know, I feel we get to this point periodically where there's sort of talk of reform and re-engagement by the US or by some other significant country, but that if we step back and pull the lens back a little bit, there are some pretty severe problems affecting the multilateral order, and that while many people agree on the outcome that we would like to see, which is more cooperation, it's far from clear how we get from here to there. So as I look at those sort of problems, it's not just that the institutions are outdated or don't reflect sort of the power structure, which is like the traditional argument that's been leveled about the multilateral order for the last 20 years. It's also that in the United States, even though we now have a government that wants to engage in multilateralism, that we have seen that the pendulum swings pretty violently from one end of the spectrum to another. And Trumpism here is still a force to be reckoned with. And it's quite possible that if President Biden were to rejoin certain institutions, the next president would simply leave them, right? And so for multilateralists or for the rest of the world, that raises not just a credibility and commitment problem, but a real sort of question about how do you embed that cooperation in a way that's sustainable and predictable. But then on the other side of the ledger, we look at China and we look at the developments there. I think the coronavirus is very instructive. You know, after 2003, the Chinese put in place many reforms to ensure there was a more transparent and cooperative response. They set up the Chinese version of CDC with expertise, many experts, many of whom were trained in the United States. and in Europe. And for 17 years, it looked like that was making progress. But when the coronavirus hit in December 2019, they went back to a more repressive, secretive approach where they did not cooperate with the international community. And that raises the question that the things that we even think are working, like that engagement with Chinese scientists and on global public health, maybe aren't as robust as they first seemed. So I think we have a series of real challenges and real problems. And what I try to do in the paper is say, there's basically three different strategic approaches that multilateralists could take to trying to address this, right? The first is the traditional one of sort of incrementalism, trying to work with all different countries, particularly with non-Western countries, gradually integrate them into the international order, focus on shared problems and shared interests, and hope that that builds out to a broader strategy of cooperation between the countries involved. But the problem with this is what we have tried, right? And it hasn't really led to convergence. It's led to divergence. And instead of having Brazil, for instance, in the international order, or India or China, as I spoke about a minute ago, there's significant divergences, and for the United States as well, right? And even in Europe, we see nationalist and populist forces pretty strong and influential in several key countries. The second approach is to basically, and I think you hear some of this from President Macron in France, is to take that core group of European countries that supports multilateralism and to for them to basically believe they're alone in the jungle, right? That they're, to use our colleague Bob Kagan's phrase from his book about the jungle growing back when the world becomes more nationalistic, and that they would work with China and Russia and the United States basically as equivalent difficult powers, right? That, and they would try to play one off against each other and make some progress on a pragmatic basis. The problem with that strategy is I think it guts the heart out of the liberal international order because it deprives it of that collective sort of basis of values that fuses the US and Europe together and gives it sort of a positive affirmative agenda. So that I think it's problematic, but we can come back to that. And then the final strategy is really a reversion to the original strategy in the late 1940s, which is to focus on like-minded countries, like-minded free societies and democratic powers, and to look at what we have in common and to propose an affirmative positive agenda that's not just defined in against another country, but is about what those countries have in common and want to see in the international system, and to basically use that to build cooperation on a more selective basis, right? And so it will be more of a international order than a global order. And it will be more defined against sort of authoritarianism than it would be working with authoritarians. In the paper, I outlined three different possible areas for cooperation: resilience, trying to ensure that free societies are more resilient to authoritarian societies and other external forces that may be damaging, like new technologies and disinformation, shaping the international order within international institutions, so competing with authoritarian powers in international institutions, and finally showing solidarity with each other when one country is a subject of coercion, as Australia, for instance, is at the moment with China, or as Canada is with China also, or as Germany was not too long ago from Saudi Arabia. So those are some of the ideas that are in the paper. And I sort of conclude by saying, look, this isn't clear cut, and I think it's going to be the subject of some debate. You can mix and match between them to some extent, but I think ultimately we do need to try to think about the trade-offs involved, and we can't just afford to muddle through thinking that by proposing sort of different multilateral agreements and just by working on sort of good faith on a subject-by-subject basis, that will be enough. So I'll leave it there, but I really look forward to the conversation. Thank you.
Terrific, thank you. Kai. Finland has been engaged in a variety of forms of multilateralism for most of its modern period. You have been sitting at the front table, ambassador to the UN, now as undersecretary. You've had a long engagement on multilateral issues, so I'd be very keen to hear your thoughts at this stage.
Thank you very much, Bruce. Good morning to the US, and it's good to be back on Tom's paper. Debating measures on how to rescue multilateralism seems to be quite popular these days on both sides of the Atlantic. Only it has produced maybe not that many policy options or alternatives. So in that sense, we very much welcome Tom's contribution. Thank you for that. Much, of course, depends on how the concept of multilateralism is, how it is defined. Here, the Russian, Chinese, and Western views are different, but everyone claims his version is the legitimate one. If you ask Moscow what they think of multilateralism, they will point to the role of the UN Security Council, and especially the role and privileges enjoyed by the permanent members of the Council. We in the EU have been quite alarmed about the state of multilateralism. And I remember when 2 years into the previous US administration, the Chinese ambassador, he was invited as a guest to the EU ambassador's weekly meeting. And he stated that China is EU's strongest partner in defending the rules-based international order and multilateralism. So we had something to digest at that meeting. But of course, there are also different interpretations in the Western camp on multilateralism. The US tradition is, I believe, rather to keep a distance to restrictions to its own sovereignty, albeit structures like the ICC might enjoy a tacit support, or at least when the Democrat-led administration is behind the steering wheel. Also in the European Union, views on multilateralism differ depending if you ask, let's say, Brussels or Budapest. But even with these lesser committed parts, I would argue that the European Union as a whole is the strongest and most consistent advocate of multilateralism and the intergovernmental cooperation. Then when it comes to the rest of the world, the situation is quite checkered and fluid and prone to changes, as we can see in cases like Brazil and India. And there I would like to make a little footnote for those who are familiar with the UN and the Security Council reform. You all know about the G4 group, a group of four governments, Germany, Japan, Brazil, and India, who claim a permanent seat on the Security Council. So I would argue that the brand of this G4 as a consequence of some recent policy pronunciations of the group members, the brand has not become stronger. So that is one perspective. Last week, we heard that America is back, diplomacy is back, and this is, of course, something we have been waiting for. Hopefully, this also means the comeback of multilateralism and coalition building. Saying that America is back is an important, essential first step. But the next steps, which are following, they probably mean a significant political reconstruction program, like almost like a Marshall plan of diplomacy. And this reconstruction program could consist of at least three and simultaneous steps. I don't know if it's possible to take three simultaneous steps, but these steps would be building back trust with the US allies and partners, First step. Second step, signaling clarity in U.S. Foreign policy. And the third step would be restoring global leadership. So trust, clarity, and leadership. And all three of these measures also serve to uphold multilateralism, the rules-based international order, and intergovernmental cooperation as we know it from the institutions created after the Second World War. On trust, there are positive early signs. There are big symbolic steps, like the early phone calls made to European leaders from the White House. But there are also smaller but very important diplomatic steps, like providing a briefing to partners after President Biden's phone call with President Putin, or making a reference to the European Human Rights Court and the will to coordinate with allies and partners in Foreign Secretary Blinken's statement after the case or arrest of Navalny. Also, it is good to start to show tact when difficult issues are addressed. And this tactfulness ties, in my view, into also showing transatlantic unity. Bringing disagreements into forefront is only benefiting those who want to split the transatlantic bond. And I think the way how High Representative Borrell was treated in Moscow was a deliberate attempt to divide the European Union and by extension also send a transatlantic signal. On the High Representative of the EU, he has also put forward, together with the Commission, a comprehensive EU-US agenda for global change, which spans four broad areas: green leadership, COVID response, global health, trade and technology, and global action and security. My final point was the number three, signaling clarity and consistency is a commendable attribute of governance and also in the execution of foreign policy. And partners should know where the U.S. Lies on certain issues. So we hope the U.S. will join Europe in taking the lead in defending the rules-based international order and multilateral institutions. Instead of being transactional, we should be transatlantic. Yes, I think this is mostly what I wanted to say. I save something for the comment round as well. Thanks, Bruce.
Very good. Constanza, I'm tempted to ask you about tact in transatlantic relations, but more generally.
I'm the wrong person to ask that.
Indeed. But no, in all seriousness, you've read Tom's paper. Kai outlined three extremely important dynamics of kind of renewing a sense of transatlantic cooperation around multilateral issues, and more broadly, I think, than transatlantic. But your thoughts on these sorts of issues?
Well, I'll keep it brief. I've been spending the weekend writing a column about Josep Borrell's foray to Moscow, the first visit of an EU official to Moscow since 2017. And I don't know, State Secretary, it seems to me that some of the things of the requirements that you listed for American foreign policy could also equally be addressed to the either high commission officials like Mr. Borrell as the foreign policy chief of the EU, or in fact to some European leaders. The foreign policy chief was treated with remarkable cynicism and brutality by his Russian counterpart. But from what I gather reports, he also didn't really push back in public. against accusations of European leaders lying about Navalny, and the EU being an unreliable partner. It seems to me that if we want things from the Americans, we have to hold up our own end. And I'm not sure that I think he did. I think I've just been reading the comments about his meeting today with the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, where the Chinese also seem to be taking a rather unfriendly tone towards us. And I would also add, on the case of the Russian visit, that immediately thereafter there was a common press conference between French President Macron and German Chancellor Merkel, in which President Macron roped back his own Europe minister, who had suggested that maybe Nord Stream wasn't such a great idea. And publicly deferred to Chancellor Merkel. And this is a project that, as you know, is dividing Europe. So I don't know, looking at all this, it just seems to me that we have some cleaning up in our own region to do when it comes to vigorous and credible multilateralism. And I think what I find most distressing about all this is that I think that we need to ask ourselves whether we're doing this with each other as EU partners. And being, as Bruce expected me to, very tactless here. I would also point out that today's news is that the US has rejoined the Human Rights Commission as an observer. That's a fairly remarkable development. Certainly a sign of good intentions. But I think the bottom line here, because I don't want to make this too long, the bottom line for me is that I think it would be helpful that if in our engagements with the leaders of authoritarian challengers like Russia and China, perhaps Washington and Brussels coordinated talking points with each other, or at least had conversations with each other about what their goals were with certain meetings, certainly with the first meeting of an EU EU leader since 2017. And then perhaps made sure that they were singing off, if not the same page, then off similar pages. And finally, on the point of leadership, I think it depends what we mean by leadership. If I read President Macron correctly, and those of us in Europe who agree with him, I'm not sure I'm one of them, I think there is a desire for the Americans to not lead. At least that's how one can read the calls for European strategic sovereignty. And there is indeed a debate, as I'm sure you've seen here in Washington, among American intellectuals and policy advisors about the conditions under which America can and should lead, and whether it was in fact not desirable for Europeans to play a much stronger role in defending the liberal international order. In which case, however, I would have to come back to my original point, which is to say that Friday's meeting with Lavrov was not an instance of that. Thank you.
Before I turn back to the panel for kind of a second round, Constance, I want to pull you up one degree farther on the question of European strategic autonomy or sovereign autonomy or whatever, you know, there's multiple different phrases. What is your thinking about the merits or demerits of sort of going down that pathway?
Look, I think that the term is, I personally think the term is unhelpful because it, you know, raises hackles in about two-thirds of Europe, as far as I can see. I think it would be more helpful to speak of greater European autonomy, self-reliance, sovereignty of action. In other words, greater European ability to bear Europe's part of the burden of international security, of alliance security, of attempts to regulate the trade and digital orders, and to cooperate in on issues like climate change and pandemics. That, I think, would already for Europe be a very tall order without without promising things that we can't keep, which is what I think the term strategic sovereignty does.
Okay, so I want to then dive in a little deeper on several issues, and I'm going to come to you in the order of Tom, Constanze again, and then Kai. Kai, just to signal in advance, one of the things I want to ask you is whether there is a merit in the question of European self-reliance and whether it pulls you in two different directions, or if it's possible to kind of be simultaneously investing with the new administration on deepening multilateralism on the one hand and at the same time building up the mechanism. So self-reliance, or are those necessarily in tension? So Tom, a challenge to you and then a question. The challenge is on incrementalism, because I have to say, if I were head of policy planning in Brasilia or New Delhi, I would not think that the West had tried incrementalism in any serious way. We didn't offer new seats in the council. We were extraordinarily truculent about G7 expansion until the global financial crisis came and we needed their money. We didn't open up to any non-American leaders or European leaders of the IMF, the World Bank. I mean, we sort of talked the talk of bringing in the BRICS or whatever. We didn't really walk that walking in any meaningful way. So I just want to kind of challenge that question that we've tried incrementalism in those terms. So you might respond to that, but then also if there are topics that you want to raise in terms of places where, sort of despite the kind of broader challenge, are there places where you think in the short term, Americans and Europeans should be working together to try to advance the multilateral agenda?
Yeah, sure. Look, I mean, I think on the incrementalism point, what that tells you, Bruce, is that incrementalism has sort of a pretty low ceiling. Because the reason why there wasn't an enlargement of the UN Security Council, as you know much better than me, was because of the politics prevented it, right? And it was gridlocked in terms of different countries objecting to different models. It's incredibly difficult, obviously, in the US to make much progress on multilateral institutions at all because of, the skepticism from Congress and because of just the inertia of the system. And so, I guess my comeback would be that if you take an incrementalist approach, not only maybe does it overestimate the degree to which other countries will sort of move, it also overestimates what we can actually do, right? And we need to be realistic about those constraints. And I know, you and I in our work on this probably share this view, I think, which is that we need to take constraints seriously, definitely push them on occasion, but recognize that they exist rather than sort of wanting to wish them away and saying, if only the US were to do this or that, or, make some big play here, and that ignores the very real, political boundaries that are in place here and in many other places. So I guess that's one reason why I'm sort of skeptical of the incrementalist approach, but definitely not the only reason. In terms of the US-European agenda, my view on this is, and you hear a lot of this from Europe at the moment in terms of the pushback against their perception that the Biden administration wants some big common agenda on China or on Russia, and even the language used in the paper, like reinvigorating the free world, that makes a lot of people nervous, I think, and they worry about the ideological dimension, and they worried about getting into a trap, where they'll be in a confrontation with China. And to some extent, they're as worried about Biden on this as they are about Trump, right? Because with Biden, it's much more, benign and friendly and compatible with their interests. And so the trap is stronger, right? They could easily get dragged into that in a way that they wouldn't with Trump, because with Trump, they're so diametrically opposed that it's easier to sort of oppose him. And so when you have Macron the other day saying, that he wanted to avoid this, and Merkel saying it as well, I think that's sort of where it's coming from. And I think it's a bit of a cultural sort of difference. I think Americans sort of talk in those sort of terms a bit more. I think that we may disagree across the Atlantic on those, on that sort of diagnosis of what to make of this, but I'm not sure we disagree all that much in the prescription on what to do, right? And if you take out those big principle discussions about the causes and consequences of the struggle we're in or not. I think, you focus on what we actually want to do, I think there is common ground. So, you know, working on the technology agenda to actually have, you know, a real democratic alternative to Huawei and ZTE in 5G, but also on AI and other new technologies. That's something I think everyone, you know, basically agrees on, and it will be a very important building block to be able to set in place, you know, new sort of rules of the road on technology. On solidarity, I think responding in concert with others when they are attacked or coerced by a larger power is incredibly important. You know, I think the US should be looking for a shared, a common response to the SolarWinds attack from Russia. But I think we need to stand with Australia in terms of what's happening to them. And I think with Canada for, you know, the two Michaels being held in captivity in China, and, you know, a whole, there's a lot of different cases in Europe as well. So I think that is a very fruitful area. And then the final one sort of mentioned in the paper is, you know, to work within these institutions, you know, within the WHO for reforms. And then if those reforms bump up against political constraints, to figure out what we need to do outside of those to be better protected the next time a pandemic hits. So I think there's a lot of things that can be done, but I think what we need to do is to be very practical and pragmatic about it, and to have it build up in the aggregate to that larger strategic vision, rather than starting with a summit, you know, talking about the strategic vision and then saying, how do we flesh it out?
Good. Constanza, do you want to add to the to-do list? You already talked about coordinating talking points and trying to align goals on Russia and China. Are there other things that would be on your early, you know, if you were whispering in Borrell's ear or whispering in Merkel's ear, what would be the early to-do list? Constanza, you're muted.
Oh God, the Zoom classic, my God. Sorry, it's Monday morning, at least where I am, or where we are, most of us. I wouldn't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. I would look for a couple of lighthouse issues and work on those, along the lines of what Tom has suggested. And I think I also wouldn't, I hear this more than I'm entirely comfortable with. I find a lot of Europeans still talking about Trump. And Trump, of course, remains a concern in that he still wants to have a career and his movement isn't gone. But I think to talk to the Biden administration about Trump and about hurt European feelings under the 4 years of Trump is a waste of time. I think that we have work to do, and we may have a very short time window to do it. And I think that I understand the European concern about how do I put this? I think there is a somewhat cynical European concern about not locking themselves into forms of cooperation with Washington that they might regret in 4 years or maybe in 2 years. And I think that is a misguided concern. I think that it, in fact, risks contributing to the failure of the Biden's administration's, I think, very sincere efforts and very organized efforts. It's been remarkable, I think, to many of us watching the speed and deliberateness with which this administration has set out its ideas and its plans. And I'm not sure that there are similarly detailed plans on the other side. There have been a lot of enthusiastic embraces, including in my own country, Germany. But I think that we have absolutely no time to lose in turning this into concrete projects that make the liberal international order more resilient.
Well, Well, I want to just add a couple of things and sort of try to summarize, and then Kai, come back to you for your thoughts and reactions. And so far we've heard a number of ideas which are in the domain of sort of trust building and sort of moving past the current moment, but then also some specific ideas around a Western alliance or democratic alliance or alternative on 5G and Huawei, tighter transatlantic coordination on Russia and China, working among the Western donors of the kind of Western powers or democratic powers at WHO. By the way, I did the math on this. The top five Western donors spend 40 times as much as China at WHO. So you would think that we would be able to grab the reins and drive reforms in a serious way. Frankly, I would not have advised the administration to rejoin the Human Rights Council early, but they have done. And then it seems to me it's very important that we try again at some of the reforms that the Trump administration tried, but tried in the kind of, extraordinary, rude, clumsy way of the Trump administration. It's not that the ideas were necessarily wrong, but the diplomacy was terrible. But let's see if we can't make some forward progress on Human Rights Council. I want to add three things. And it would be interesting, Kai, to get your sense of the status of play in the European Center of Excellence on hybrid threats. But it seems to me that the core dynamic there, the notion of working between NATO and the European Union to really push on this question of hybrid threats is pretty important. It's dropped down the radar a little bit in Washington. I'd be interested in your thoughts of what could be done to kind of bolster transatlantic investment in that mechanism and in that project. I would emphasize COVAX. The United States has rejoined COVAX. I definitely welcome that rejoining of the multilateral system. But making COVAX a success and really putting a huge amount of muscle through the G7, through the EU, through transatlantic efforts, whatever it takes to get vaccines distributed to the developing world is going to be crucial. We're just massively behind the curve. Obviously, countries are going to look to vaccinate their own populations first, but moving as quickly as possible to be spreading vaccine distribution in the developing world and conflict-affected countries, all these kinds of things are going to be challenging, but are hugely consequential even for our own sustained recovery. And then finally, Kai, I'd be curious as to your thoughts of whether the work on sort of UN 75 and the common agenda is a place into which to try to pull some of these issues, or is that quite a separate show. So Kai, your thoughts or reactions?
Yeah, quite a list. Thanks, Bruce. But let me just come back on a couple of things Constanza said. Of course, for a Brookings fellow, it's easier to comment on Borrell's trip to Moscow. I think the intergovernmental or EU internal discussion is still to be held, and we are following it very, very closely, and we are participating in it, of course. Then on the EU strategic autonomy. I would also second Constanza here, at least partially. The definition might be a bit contaminated and also perhaps a bit outdated, since the strategic autonomy originally, I think, was more referring to security and military capabilities, and now in the middle of the pandemic crisis, we are talking about the security of supply, industrial reserves, etc. So it is broader, and maybe a new definition or new concept would be required. Your peer institute in the Netherlands, Klingendaal, they had quite a clever concept, the ability to act together with partners when possible and alone when needed. I think it's a neat way to put it. Human Rights Council, yes, US is coming back to the Human Rights Council as well. But take note, it's not a free ride. There will be an election and the US is competing against us and Italy and Luxembourg. So there are four candidates currently for three seats. It will be an interesting campaign. We are trying to do to promote multilateralism is also to create a national action plan. We are rather forward-looking and a bit frustrated with the fact that we seem to run in circles here. Not much new is offered to the discussion, and we would like to find new avenues also for the transatlantic partnership to reinforce multilateralism. And one area, and I name this more as an example, is climate change, where Finland, together with Chile, we have been running a coalition of ministers of finance. And the basic, the common denominator is that in budgeting and procurement, I mean, in the vast area of public expenses, you need to take into consideration climate change. So this is the philosophy and approach, and the number of governments who have joined this initiative is quite large, and I think there's room for the US to join as well. Just to name one example. Also, the European Commission
Kai, I think you're frozen there somehow.
Preparing a communication on the debate will definitely current issues which are filling the agenda.
Kai, I'm having a little difficulty hearing you. Tom or Constanza, are you also having that, or is that me? You're also here. You're having difficulty. So, Kai, you might need to check your connection. You appear to be frozen. So I'm going to
maybe I'll leave it at something very important. I'm the whole question security and 5G. So it's a whole I think EU. That's all.
Okay, we lost a couple of things there. You were a little bit broken, but we'll give you a chance to come back. We picked up most of what you said about climate change, and then we lost a little bit, and then we caught the point about 5G. So if we missed something critical, you come back. But let me just then turn to Tom and Constanza for any comments, and then we'll open up to questions from the audience. People can still pose questions by sending them to events@brookings.edu or on Twitter at foreignpolicy2021. Tom, Constanza, any thoughts so far?
Yeah, I can just say something on the climate piece, Bruce, because this is the subject of some debate at the moment, which I've been a little bit a part of, but it's really how does climate fit into the broader multilateral agenda, you know, and is it something that is so existential and important that it should be sort of a driver in the relationship between the US and Europe on the one hand and China on the other, and that we should have more of a climate-centric, you know, China policy in which other issues would be sort of linked to it and you'd have to have an overall positive relationship? Or would that be, you know, dangerous because it potentially would allow Beijing to have leverage and it could lead to deterioration in the relationship as things are linked? And then sort of a third view, which comes interestingly enough from Europe. There's an interesting report by the European Council on Foreign Relations recently on this, saying that climate will actually be a driver of competition as much as it will be of cooperation, because you'll have contestation with China over access to various materials and for clean technology, and that we're likely to see more of a competitive dimension. So I think climate is one of those things that will be very much on and high on the multilateral agenda, but it's very unclear, I think, exactly how it will play out at this stage. I think it would be interesting to sort of, you know, in the years to come to sort of explore that and to see exactly what does it mean to have sort of an effective multilateral approach toward toward climate? Is that more the like-minded? Is it more universal? Does it select more for cooperation, or is it sort of compatible with a more competitive world?
But to confess, I increasingly view the topic, we've always sort of approached it as a kind of global issues topic. In a lot of my writing, I've tried to approach it as a great powers topic in the sense that, you know, it's only a handful of entities whose emissions account for 90% of global emissions. And you either get them working out or you don't. And among them, it seems to me the approach is it's more analogous to arms control. It's a question of verification. And we, you know, we don't have any real verification mechanisms. We're laggards. I mean, we're not, you know, the challenge is not to get China to come to the table. We haven't been to the table, but we don't really trust what China says they're going to do. And frankly, people aren't going to trust us when we say what we're going to do. And developing a verification and monitoring mechanism seems to be to the core of the climate thing, not negotiations with China. That's a separate, I mean, yes, there'll be ongoing negotiations, but it's not like we have to negotiate with them on our national commitment or others. The real challenge comes in monitoring and verification. We might come back to that, but Constanza.
Well, I'm just to come in on the back of that, Bruce. Similar things are true for some major European nations, including mine. Germany notably has one of the strongest Fridays for Future movements on the continent, but our energy policy, shall we say, is a bit incoherent and heavily dependent still on coal and fossil fuels, not least fossil fuel imports from Russia. But the coal aspect is the one we are, I think, unhappiest about talking about. As for competition, I think we need to be very clear that America and Europeans will be disagreeing and competing with each other on some issues. But it is precisely because we need each other in the competition with authoritarian challengers, because we don't have the luxury of foregoing each other's support anymore, is where it's most important for us, I think, to not sort of go off on our own without being absolutely certain that we can then hold our own. And it seems to me that forgive me, Mr. Zara, but that the Borrell visit to Moscow shows that there is a, you know, the Russians play hardball. And if we want to have these conversations with the Russians, then we have to be prepared to play hardball as well. And I think if we're not prepared to do that, then we had probably better come armed with a transatlantic approach rather than coming on our own. That's my only point here. I don't mind Europeans staking out their own positions or disagreeing with the Americans. I think that's going to be necessary and become more of the norm. But if so, we're going to have to be prepared to actually succeed.
Good. It does seem to me, too, that there's going to likely be some substantial differences between Europe and the United States on China. There are differences within the United States. There are differences within Europe. But certainly at the kind of top level, it was interesting to see, although it was tactful, that Jake's very first tweet was a bit of a dig at your countrywoman, Angela Merkel, for her deal making with the Chinese on investment. It was literally his first tweet as national security advisor, kind of essentially criticizing Europe for not consulting with the United States. But there, frankly, it seems to me that the United States is going to have its backs against the wall. I mean, if we see Japan, Australia, Germany all signing trade deals with the Chinese in the first days and weeks of a new administration, and it seems to me we may have some difficulties bringing allies to our view on the economic side of the China equation. Let me offer Kai an opportunity to say anything he wants at this stage, and then I want to raise some questions that have come in from the audience. Kai, anything you want to add at this juncture?
Yeah, maybe just to fill the gap which I left in the previous statement, that hybrid security definitely is one area where we can work together with the Americans, and this ties into the 5G topic as well as in the cybersecurity area. Yeah. Frau Stelzenmüller, you don't have to apologize to me. I agree that the EU needs a pushback when dealing with the Russians. Absolutely. I don't know. I misspoke, but I fully agree with that. I was just saying that the Russians abused the situation and trying to divide the European Union with that. But good. I think one area we have not discussed today and is the development part, and there are a number of issues on the development side, like the LGBTI, the gender policy, etc., which is also going to change, and it offers certainly good areas for cooperation and multilateralism. But in Europe, I don't think we are under any false illusions. We all know that this might not be permanent. We might face again a different administration in 4 years, and unless there are acts in the Congress, it is easy to reverse the policies introduced by this administration. So this is a big question for us as well. Thank you, Bruce.
I'm going to turn to some questions from the audience in a moment, but on this, it does seem to me that there would be places. Let's just take WHO. If you take EU funding, German funding, British funding, Gates Foundation, and the sort of the remainder of the top European donors, you are about, you know, twice as large as the United States, 40 times larger than China. That coalition of actors could do a great deal to improve WHO monitoring on infectious diseases, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and not be entirely reliant on the United States being part of that. The United States is part of it. It's going to be easier if the United States falls out again. Okay, we can still manage. So it does seem to me that part of the approach, if I were sitting in Ottawa or in Brussels, part of the approach would be to see where are there places where a constellation of actors could advance the agenda, preferably with the United States, ideally with the Chinese, but ultimately, if neither of them are willing to play ball, we can still advance. That's obviously harder in some areas than others. Going to questions from the audience and issues that came up. It is noticeable, I have to say, that here we are in 2021. We're almost an hour into this conversation and the Middle East hasn't come up so far. But there are still major issues in the Middle East, and I'd be curious. So that's one. I'm going to just list two or three questions, and then you can each pick which you'd like to address. Questions about the Middle East writ large, and whether there are places where there is a possibility to improve the dynamics of cooperation and multilateralism on the Middle East. We could add Iran to that agenda, which will come up early. Questions of JCPOA or JCPOA plus will come up early. Second topic, which is near and dear to Klaus Stetzenmüller's heart, is questions of international law and human rights. And I think Kai also, to finish foreign policy, questions of sort of rule of law, in particular in the kind of, you know, Central and Eastern Europe, Hungary's, et cetera. What options are there for strengthening approaches to the defense of rule of law and human rights? And a third set of topics which have come up are around issues around the G8 and the G20, or the G7 and the G20, whether there is any value and merit in reforms there. I've already been in some conversations with British colleagues around this question of whether or not the sort of temporary invitations to India, South Korea, and Australia is or should be a move to a D10 or not, or are we sticking with the G7? And there continue to be debates around the G20, whether it's warranted to kind of deepen the institutionalization of the G20 around, at least around global public goods questions. On development issues, I do think, Kai, that it is pretty striking to see I don't think we've ever seen, even under Obama, we haven't seen the kind of forward-leaning language on LGBTIQ issues. It came already from the Biden administration with Samantha Power at USAID. I think you'll see a very forward-leaning sort of American development strategy. And the question then, I think, to Europeans and to others is how much can you kind of capture in 4 years, knowing that it might not survive, even a change in the Democratic Party might not be quite so forward-leaning. So in no particular order, Tom, I'm going to go to you first and see if you want to come in on any of those, and then I'll go to Kai and then to Constanza, or the other way around.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. I think I'll take the Middle East one because I think this is a pretty good example, actually, of how do we get here from there, or how do we get there from here. So if you look at the JCPOA, I think the Biden administration has a problem in that it's stuck really between a rock and a hard place on this, right? So if they get a deal, get back into the deal or get a new deal that doesn't have support in the region from the Gulf Arab states and from Israel and doesn't have support in Washington, D.C., because there's, you know, opposition in Congress, all of the Republicans and some Democrats, and to some extent those two things are linked. The region is against it. They have enough levers to pull in Washington that Washington is probably against it. I don't see how such an outcome is viable, right, or sustainable. I mean, they can pull it off potentially, but it's hard to see how that would last, right, and would sort of stand up to the winds of political change that will come maybe in 4 years' time, maybe in 8 years' time, or maybe somewhere in the middle. On the other hand, you know, if they don't get Iran back into the deal, obviously then they don't have sort of a deal, but everything they do to try to get Iran in exacerbates the problem with the first group, right, in the region and in Washington, and vice versa, right? To any extent to which those negotiations are opened up, you basically make it much less likely that Iran will get back into compliance. And so I think the one thing that they can do to try to solve that puzzle is the one thing that they're incapable of doing, right, which is to do nothing and to sort of step back after the initial compliance for compliance offer fails, which it probably will, right, that they would step back and focus on other things and maybe let the situation deteriorate a little bit to the point where others say, we want you to come back in, we need you to come back to negotiate, right? So to the extent that we sort of try to reassure everyone simultaneously, I think you just end up with a total sort of mess where you're trying to do the impossible, right? And I think it's going to be very difficult for them to do that because, you know, they have sort of the activist gene, which is to get in early, to be very intensive on diplomacy and to try to bring everyone to the table. But I just don't see, given the current makeup, how that works. And while I very much support working with Europe and the JCPOA, just from a pure sort of political lens in terms of making sure that this thing works, you know, domestically and internationally, you know, Europe is not the region, right? The region is the region. It's Israel, it's Saudi Arabia, it's the UAE. They're very difficult to deal with on this, but they are actually there. So I think it is, you know, I'd much prefer to be negotiating with France and with Germany on it. But I think they need an answer to that. And I'm a little perturbed just in the general conversation on this, that we sort of assume that the JCPOA is just something, you know, that can be resurrected. You know, we've just been through this where it was negotiated and then it fell apart because Trump pulled out. So we need an answer to that. I support getting back in. I support compliance for compliance and hope there's a chance of saving it. But I think it is one where we need some realpolitik in the tactics of actually pulling it off.
Constanza.
Well, I mean, on that, staying in the Middle East, you know, we have problems closer to home that we're currently failing to successfully grapple with. And one of those is the conflict between Turkey and Greece over natural gas in the Eastern Mediterranean and maritime delimitations. Again, these are NATO member states. Greece is an EU member state. Turkey is at least nominally still a candidate. And all of that is embedded in an increasingly fraught region in security terms that is, you know, a lot closer to Europe than is Iran. And that where most of the southern EU member states don't want NATO involvement, don't want a NATO framework for talking about this. But there are some the general security temperature is heating up, given goings on in Libya, Mali, Northern Africa generally, and so on. And I think the question for me still remains, you know, we can talk about the JCPOA, but meanwhile, is the clock for Iranian nuclear weapons ticking down for the Israelis? And will the Israelis be tempted to use some of their new friendly relations with some of the Gulf states for acting on this worry? In other words, I think that we fail to understand the urgency and the intensity of the different sort of hotspots heating up in the Middle East at this point. If we don't address that we're already failing to address it as Europeans. But I think that we could use some help here in thinking this through from the Americans. And I agree with Tom that activism probably, you know, this requires some extremely delicate handling. But I can see a lot of different scenarios where this could get seriously out of hand and create not just security situations that would be hard to handle for the Europeans on their own, but new migration flows.
Do you want to say some things about rule of law issues before I turn to Kai?
Well, honestly, you know, again, you look at the European Union's sort of troubles with addressing rule of law issues in some of its member states. And of course, that's a hindrance for us in addressing them in conversations with Russia and with China. That's not something we can blame the Americans for. But again, Tom's made this point, and I don't want to belabor it, but I think the one sort of comparative advantage that we have in systemic competition with authoritarian challenges is the resilience and the credibility of our own democratic constitutional orders. So we can ask, or we can support the rights of civil societies or minorities to not be oppressed in Myanmar, in Taiwan, in the Uyghurs, and in Russia, but the reality is, if we can't manage to address this at home, then that significantly undermines our effectiveness and credibility abroad.
I will say, you know, I listened carefully to President Biden's speech at State Department. Frankly, I thought it was a bit sleepy, a bit dull, and maybe that's just a very welcome thing after the kind of traumas and changes of the previous period. But the place where it sort of was most lively in a way was when he was talking about white supremacy in the United States. And it was very striking to hear a president of the United States talk about the need to tackle white supremacy in this country as part of an agenda of rejuvenating American leadership. Kai, your thoughts at this stage, and then I'm gonna do one last round.
I wanted to come back on your question on the Middle East. Very, very good topic, as are other conflicts as well. One thing we haven't referred to today are the Western Balkans. They are still there. We are painfully aware of it. And traditionally, it has been an area for a strong transatlantic partnership, which was then, during the Trump administration, there was a little bit of improvisation from the U.S. side. But now I think on the European side, the expectations are that the cooperation will continue strongly. But on the Middle East, I think what is interesting here, and I'm not going into the individual cases, but the regional approach. And if you look at the work of ICG during Rob Malley, ICG was very much in favor of a regional solution, or at least a regional approach in the area, which was actually seconded by nobody. at least not by the countries in the region. But then when Rob Malley changes from ICG to the US administration, there might be some incentives in the region also to rethink their approach. And this is quite interesting. And we, as the Finnish government, we have been involved in supporting this kind of conceptualizing this thinking. And it will be very interesting to see how far we will get with that. There is still some pushback from the region, but not as strong as before. And then, of course, Afghanistan is highly interesting to us since we have been there with our troop or our contingent for some time. And now there seems to be some momentum towards scaling down the presence. But then again, is it based on realistic expectations? I'm not so sure. So that is something which will keep us busy. Thank you.
Good. I'm going to do a final round. We just have a few minutes left. What I'd like to do is ask each of you to reflect on the following question. Let me just premise this with the following point. It seems to me that in the Biden administration, and this is just a kind of a secular trend in Washington, with which the Trump administration was an exception. There's a lot more interest and knowledge about the EU in the United States now than 10 years ago, right? 10 years ago, if you asked the US about Europe, it was a NATO question. Now there's a much more serious focus on the EU. Is that the place where the transatlantic discussion should happen? Is it NATO plus the EU? Is it rejuvenating the Quad? Do we need a new mechanism given the changing configuration of power? Or is the real agenda about coordinating policy in the G20, in the G7, at the UN? Sort of where is the action? Is it in the EU? Is it in small groups? Or is it in sort of caucuses within wider multilateral institutions? I'll give Kai the final word, so I'll go to Tom, Constanza, and Kai on that.
Yeah, thank you. I'm looking at this as from a practitioner's perspective, and of course now everybody is kind of thinking when will the high level contacts take place, and the best guess it is in the margins of the G7 in London in mid June, and this would then also entail a visit to Brussels with the EU countries, and of course a visit to NATO. And this definitely makes a lot of sense. But then I think from the US perspective, it would also be wise to break it down into like-minded group. I mean, as we all have said, the EU is not like-minded in all areas, rule of law being a good example. So if you want to achieve something in democracy promotion, rule of law, human rights, et cetera, you might go to the Nordics or just come to Helsinki or Stockholm or Oslo. So there are differences, of course. But I would also invest in bilateral relations here. It is hugely important, and there are quite high expectations on this side of the Atlantic. Thank you.
Constanza, I'm going to let Tom have a final word. So, Constanza, your thoughts on sort of where this dialogue occurs and what those sets of issues are.
You know, I don't have a problem with sort of coalitions on the willing on uncertain issues. I think that may be a practical way forward. And I realize that in particular that there are many European countries for whom their bilateral relations with the United States are very important. I get that. I mean, that's true for Germany as well. But I do worry that there is, you know, such a thing as systems overload. I think we're seeing an American system that is going to have to prioritize much more ruthlessly than it has in the past. is going to have to concentrate much more than in the past, specifically because of the time issues that we've mentioned. And I think we have to, that the value of America's democratic European allies lies precisely in whether we are helpful in framing and implementing those goals quickly. And there I would suggest there might be a trade-off between the EU-level approach and the bilateral approach.
A quick question to you before I go to Tom. Germany takes over the G7 after the UK. How do you see Germany dealing with these issues a year from now? Is this going to be central to that agenda, or how do you see that?
You know what? That's very much going to depend on what government we have.
Yeah, fair enough.
and we have elections on September 26th, the end of the Merkel era. And while I think the likeliest option is a coalition of conservatives and Greens, I think we could have a lot more sort of inward-lookingness and political volatility than people elsewhere, and including in this town, like to think. So I don't think that's a question I can answer for you now in a satisfactory way. Sorry.
Fair enough. Tom, final thoughts.
Yeah, just two comments. I mean, I hope the EU is elevated to sort of a similar position as NATO in US policymaking for the next 4 years. The EU has most of the competencies required for sort of competing with China, Russia, and others. I mean, there's no NATO financial ministerial meeting, right? Most of the domains of competition fall more naturally within the EU. NATO still has some very important ones, but I think the EU is somewhere where the US is sort of underinvested and has sort of a general lack of understanding. And I think, you know, hopefully the Biden administration will sort of lean into that. The second thing is that I think it's really important that relations with Europe are outcome focused rather than just consultation focused.
Yes.
You know, it's very easy to have sort of dialogues and meetings and discussions, but let's have some product, you know, and let's have some, whether it's plurilateral or minilateral or whatever sort of the format is, but let's try to focus on, you know, some coalitions that would actually do something, you know, whether it's on the technology side or counter coercion or whatever, and begin to put those in place. So at the end of the 4 years, there actually is a wide array of strategic initiatives, right, that in the aggregate would amount to something sort of significant. You know, it might be more like the Proliferation Security Initiative from the early 2000s than it would be like a formal multilateral organization, but I think keeping it outcome focused is incredibly important. But this is terrific. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Likewise.
It seems very apt somehow in a strange, weird way to end by citing John Bolton's A Major Multilateral Initiative as the pathway forward. So in fact, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to end with Emily Haber, actually, who today put out an important statement citing George Shultz's piece that he wrote before he died, still at 100, about trust and how essential trust was in all aspects of life, but including in foreign policy. And I think that although we came through a number of specifics and topics and frameworks and et cetera, we did start with questions of the dynamic of trust in the relationship and in multilateralism in general. And I think we'll want to come back to that. I want to thank Adam Jaworski, Suzanne Schaefer, and above all, Filippos Lestas for helping us all put this all together. A huge thanks to the colleagues on the Finnish side as well, to Tom and to Constanza, and above all, Kai, thank you to you for being with us today and for engaging with us on these topics. We'll continue to try to push forward for a rules-based order in some format. So thank you all.
And it would have been more fun to do this in Finland.
Thanks, Bruce.